Health care wasn't easy for the Democrats, and it's not easy for the Republicans either. We'll take the pulse of both parties on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The Republican health care failure has led to lots of finger-pointing. How will it affect the rest of President Trump's agenda?
Donald Trump promised a lot, and it's easy to promise when you're on a campaign, when you're a political outsider, when you really don't know what it takes to pass legislation. He, of course, has some early achievements in terms of executive orders, right, but is finding that Washington has its own mind.
Plus, get ready for more fireworks as we approach the Senate vote on Neil Gorsuch.
Many Democrats, and I think Republicans too, are deeply concerned about the dysfunction in the Senate on the approval of judges. I do think whether you decide to evaluate Judge Gorsuch entirely on the merits without other considerations, the end result is the same. He should not be confirmed to the Supreme Court.
And how about that shocking announcement from the President of the United States 49 years ago this week?
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 172 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It has not been a fun time for the Trump administration. Both of its attempts at coming up with a travel ban were blocked by the federal courts. The director of the FBI said there was no evidence to back up the president's tweet that he was bugged by the Obama White House. New questions about ties between Trump allies and even relatives and Russia. And now a crushing defeat in its first major push for a legislative victory. The failure of the American Health Care Act to even make it to the floor of the House for a vote. Remember this boast by the campaigning Donald Trump?
We're going to turn it around, and we're going to start winning again. We're going to win so much. We're going to win at every level. We're going to win economically. We're going to win with the economy. We're going to win with military. We're going to win with health care and for our veterans. We're going to win with every single facet. We're going to win so much, you may even get tired of winning.
Well, they're not doing much winning these days. And the obvious follow-up is, when do they start winning? Neil Gorsuch may make it to the Supreme Court, but tax overhaul, the budget, infrastructure spending, these may suddenly have become more elusive. Stu Rothenberg has been around Washington long enough to know whether this is a worrisome development or a temporary blip, and he's back on The Political Junkie to share his observations. Stu, you've been around long enough. That's a compliment there somewhere, isn't it?
Right. I survived this long. Another few weeks I can handle, Ken.
Well, you know, 7 years of talking replace and repeal, repeal and replace, and this is what happens when they get their chance. What is going on?
Well, I think a lot of people who've spent time in and around Washington are not totally surprised. I mean, Donald Trump promised a lot, and it's easy to promise when you're on a campaign, when you're a political outsider, when you really don't know what it takes to pass legislation. He, of course, has some early achievements in terms of executive orders, right, and changing rules and regulations.
And moving away from the Obama legacy.
Oh, absolutely. But in terms of long-term policy through legislation, even the executive orders, he's finding that Washington has its own mind. We don't have a unitary government here. We don't have an autocrat who just decides what the laws are going to be and can promulgate these rules and regulations. It's a complicated system. People don't like that. In this case, there are a lot of people are actually thankful that the system is so complicated. It's hard to change. You know, what they say is you can't turn a battleship on a dime. You can't turn the U.S. government on about a half dollar.
But I was going to say that it's not only Donald Trump who, you know, given what he campaigned on and reality, but it's also Republicans from 2009, 2010. They've been saying the first time, the moment we get a chance to change, get rid of Obamacare, we do it. They never even had a plan.
The rhetoric of campaigns is very different than the reality of governing.
Can I quote you on that?
Yeah, that's a nice phrase I just came up with.
What's your name?
It's, you know, it's really look, they took all these, they took dozens of votes.
60, yeah.
Dozens.
Right, okay.
And the Republicans voted for the repeal because they knew it couldn't take place. They knew the Senate wouldn't allow it, and the White House, of course, wouldn't allow it. So now you've got to govern, and yeah, it's complicated.
It's like what do you do when you're so used to voting no? What happens when it's time to vote yes?
Well, that's particularly the case of the House Freedom Caucus, which really is so skeptical about government, so supportive of individual rights, and they don't want higher taxes, they don't want more spending, and they don't want more restrictions. Well, you know, that puts them on the fringe of the Republican Party. And as long as they're voting no, the Republican leadership has to get some yes votes somewhere else. And Paul Ryan and Kevin Brady, they couldn't even keep all the moderate Republicans. So, you know, this is the modern Republican Party. It's kind of a mess.
I was going to say, I mean, I know that Donald Trump pointed fingers after the bill was withdrawn from consideration. Matter of fact, I think the first people he blamed were Democrats, which is kind of remarkable.
Pelosi and Schumer, right. He said, now the legislation is in their lap. Well, it's been in their lap for the last 8 years.
But I mean, it's not only again, if we're looking for people to blame, and in Washington, we love to look for people to blame, but it's not only the Freedom Caucus. I mean, you point out, it's the Frelinghuysens and other moderates who said this is not good. And you have, you know, you'll have millions more without insurance coverage. You know.
Well, you wonder if the Republicans had not, if the leadership hadn't started talking about eliminating essential benefits, and if they had treated Medicaid a bit more delicately, they may have kept the moderate Republicans. But this is a party with just enough Freedom Caucus guys and just enough moderates so that you have to walk a very difficult balance. And the balance is easier to walk than in the opposition. You're just you oppose Barack Obama, you oppose his legislation, the ACA.
That's easy.
Easy to do. I was watching Charlie Dent just the other day.
The moderate Republican from
Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and he was commenting, well, I voted to repeal Obamacare. You know, I didn't vote for Obamacare initially. I was against it. But when you have to support something, it's more difficult. It's easier to say, well, I don't like this, or I don't like this, or my constituents won't like this. When you know you can't pass anything, what the heck? Then you don't have to worry about the details.
What do we learn about Speaker Ryan in all of this? And has his role, what's his role now?
I think what we learned is there's a little bit of shine off the golden boy. Those of us who've been following politics for many years, for decades.
You covered Speaker Longworth, didn't you?
I don't know if I've told you this before. I interviewed Paul Ryan when he was first running for Congress, and he came in.
I like that.
And he was running in the Wisconsin's 1st District. He had been a staffer for Sam Brownback, who was then a senator from Kansas. I guess he was a senator at the time. Anyway, so this young kid, he's like 28 years old, Brian comes in. You know, we meet with candidates for about an hour, start with date of birth, what'd your folks do for a living, where'd you go to school, what was your first job, you know, where have you worked.
Do you have any campaign buttons?
Then talk about, we don't ask that, although I should have asked that for you. Seen. For you, yeah.
You know, I collect campaign
buttons. I heard that. Yeah, the universe knows that. You know, what's your campaign like? What's your message? How much money have you raised? Anyway, at the end of this message, so at the end of the interview, he says to me something candidates never say. He said, how did I do? How did I do? Huh. So he was like, he's like 28 years old at this time. And he's the staffer, and he's running in this very competitive district, but difficult, but competitive. I think it was a district that...
Newman?
Mark Newman. Newman. That's different than Newman. Mark Newman and Les Aspin.
Aspin, right.
So, and then there was another guy for one term,
Democrat. Baca?
Yes, that guy.
I'm conjugating his name right before my eyes.
Paul Ryan asked me how did he do, and I said to him, I was honest with him, I said, I thought you did really well. I have followed him since then, and I have always had the highest regard because he is smart. He does care about policy. He does know politics. I mean, he's one of those well-rounded figures. But some of this was Paul Ryan, I think, offering expectations that were overly great, grandiose. And some of it is trying to work with the White House, I think.
I thought a lot of the things that Trump did, one, saying that first he said, okay, I've washed my hands of this. I'm not going to do it anymore. Then, and he also threatened primary challenges. I know people say he was joking, But I suspect he was really, I mean, like, you don't vote for this, you know, watch your back in 2018.
Well, that's been his M.O. generally throughout life, so, yeah.
But I was going to say, do you think, first of one, do you think he's capable of doing heavy lifting? Two, do you think he actually knew what was in the bill? And three, maybe do you think he read all the copy about how he's a great deal maker? And ultimately, it's different in the private sector than it is on Capitol Hill, that's for sure.
I love those questions you asked. And I agree. I had to laugh when news reports said the president decided to pull the bill. He doesn't know. Let's be honest. Donald Trump doesn't know what's in the bill.
That's what I thought.
He couldn't. Who did I read? I watched an interview. I think it might have been Mo Brooks, or I read an interview, the congressman from Alabama, who said, you know, the president called me in, called a bunch of us in, and he's trying to convince us to vote for the bill. He never talked about provisions of the bill. He never talked policy. Yeah. It was all politics, how we have to win. It's about winning. You and I should win. We'll win now. We'll win more. You know, that clip you ran about so much winning. I just don't think he's interested in the details. Now, you don't have to be interested in the details to be a successful president. I'm not sure Ronald Reagan was so detail-oriented. And we've had people who supposedly were very detailed-oriented that didn't do great. Jimmy Carter, everybody said, oh, yeah, he's in the weeds and he's really smart. And so you don't have to have a certain style. But I think this president is remarkably detached. I'll tell you, I found it rather disconcerting. Now, maybe this is just my bias, and that could be. That's fine. When Paul Ryan said, oh, yeah, I talked to the president about it, and he's right in the weeds on this, and he's in the details, I don't believe that for a minute. He's just not a detailed guy. That's not the kind of businessman he was. And I'm sure he knows some details when we're talking about real estate and financing and things like that. But I can't believe he was in the details on health care, insurance, public policy, and the like.
Do you think it affects the attempts at other things on the agenda, tax overhaul, infrastructure with an R, debt ceiling, all those things that are supposedly on the Republican list? It shows that Trump is not a winner. It shows that it probably emboldens the Democrats to have a little more spine. Do you think it weakens the president's hand?
I think it's probably the conventional wisdom to say that. I don't really believe that, except in one way that I'll mention in a moment. Look, everybody, you want to build up momentum. You want to build a sense of inevitability. You're a winner, as Donald Trump says, and you can't be stopped. So that would be good, and he didn't get that. But there will be a burden on Republicans who defected to now come back home. They know they're on the hook for something. They've got to do. They failed to do health care. They've got to do something big or bigger. The one problem is I believe in terms of tax reform, the Republicans were counting on some budget savings from the health care bill. And without those savings, it may be harder to do what the Republicans want to do on tax reform. Having said that, I still believe there's going to be a major effort to do something on cutting rates and repatriating cash that's overseas. And you know, I think there's a tendency to overread. Oh, well, he failed there, so now that means he's powerless.
Yeah, but tax overhaul, that hasn't happened since 1986. It's not an easy thing to do.
Well, I don't think we're going to have a fundamental tax overhaul. Okay. In other words, I don't think we're going to get rid of deductions and, you know, the mortgage deduction and the charitable deduction and all these gifts to certain industries. I don't think that, but I think they have to come up with some sort of tax cut, probably corporate, individual, and repatriation of cash. Now, that won't be tax reform, but it'll be changes in the laws. Now, the question then you're going to ask me is, where are they going to get the revenue to offset that?
Where are they going to get the revenue to offset that?
Part of that was coming from healthcare, but the bigger part comes from border adjustment tax, which looks like it is failing
now.
Yeah,
sure.
So there is a question on where the additional revenue is going to come to make up for the shortfall.
I can't let you go without talking about what's going on with the House Intelligence Committee. How would you assess the job that Chairman Devin Nunes is doing?
The committee is a partisan mess now. I heard Charlie Dent again, the pragmatic moderate Republican from Pennsylvania. He's sort of moderate conservative, say that he thinks that the House Intelligence Committee now can't handle this, that they should just suspend their investigation and let the Senate committee do it, because he believes the House committee is so split along partisan lines, and there's so much distrust that they won't be able to accomplish much.
It's more than partisan suspicion. It's the fact that you had the Republican chairman doing Donald Trump's bidding, going on White House grounds, getting classified information without sharing it with the Democrats. I mean, I understand Adam Schiff and the Democrats have their own agenda, but this seems to me Devin Nunes just sabotaging any kind of a hope for a fair investigation.
Well, he has an argument about it. He was doing an investigation himself, and this is the sort of thing that chairmen have done in the past. So you may well be right. I certainly agree with you. The bottom line is it's hard to see any goodwill. There is a sense each side challenges the other's motives. The Republicans think that the Democrats are simply trying to torpedo the White House, and Democrats are thinking that the House Republicans are basically in cahoots with the White House. They're not running an independent investigation. So it's hard to see. You know, it's now like a marriage that is both sides have a lot of baggage that's built up.
Okay, final question. Prediction on Gorsuch nomination. Do they implement the nuclear option? What's the final vote?
I have no idea what the final vote is. They will implement the nuclear option if they need it. Gorsuch will be...
Well, they need it. They're not going to get 60.
He will be confirmed on the Supreme Court. Right. There's no doubt in my mind.
Agree.
I've been saying this for a long time. If they're able to get, you know, the Manchins and the Heidi Heitkamp and those of the world and get up to 60, fine. They would prefer to do it that way. But the idea that they will let this nomination die on the vine because they, you know, can't get 60 votes is nuts.
Stu Rothenberg is a longtime elections analyst. He has a new piece out this week making the case that the House is in play in 2018. You can find it at InsideElections.com. Stu, thank you as always.
Thanks, Ken.
And speaking of the House and 2018, here's this week's trivia question. Since World War II, what Republican president saw the biggest loss in House seats in the midterm election 2 years into his first term? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. All this frustration, all this frustration. Put down our eyes on a butterfly's wings. All this frustration, all this frustration. Who gave the leopard spots and taught the birds to sing? Born of frustration. Democrats, struggling for a battle plan in the fight over Neil Gorsuch's Supreme Court nomination, have decided to filibuster the nomination. That may not stop him from getting on the court, but they will force the Republicans to change the rules to make it happen. Still, there's a new bounce in the Democrats' step this week, ever since the collapse of the Trump-Ryan GOP health care plan. Among those who have been battling the Gorsuch nomination from the start is the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, a coalition of more than 200 civil rights and human rights groups. Wade Henderson has headed up that organization for the past 20 years and joins us to talk about their latest campaign. Wade Henderson, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Delighted to be here.
Well, we're thrilled you're here, and I really appreciate it. Do you buy the argument that Neil Gorsuch is certain to join the Supreme Court one way or the other?
Not at all. I think the jury is still out on whether the Senate in its entirety will actually approve, assuming the filibuster is implemented, which I think it will be, whether the Senate in its entirety will approve the so-called nuclear option, which is to eliminate the filibuster with a majority of Senate votes and then have a vote on the nomination. I'm not convinced that all senators will agree with it. I certainly know that many Democrats will not, but I also suspect that you'll find some Republicans are true institutionalists who are committed to keeping the Senate functioning to the extent that it can, using existing rules. So no, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion at all that Neil Gorsuch will be confirmed.
So your argument is not so much that he doesn't have majority support in the Senate with 52 Republicans, it's whether a majority of the Republicans will vote to change the rules the way the Democrats did in 2013.
No, that's exactly right. First of all, I think credit is due to Senator Schumer, the minority leader, for articulating the 60-vote standard that all Supreme Court nominees should be required to adhere to. Certainly the last four nominees who were actually approved and are now serving on the court, two from President George W. Bush, two from President Obama, were required to meet the 60-vote standard. The 60-vote standard is, in essence, a standard which says that senators with a bipartisan majority are prepared to support the confirmation of a Supreme Court nominee. It's a reasonable standard. Certainly, I think both Democrats and Republicans believe that that kind of standard ensures the level of bipartisan cooperation which is necessary to get buy-in and support for whoever the Supreme Court nominee is. I certainly think that with Senator Schumer having articulated that, with every member of the Democratic caucus agreeing to it, and many Republicans as well, whether they are prepared to admit it or not, may well insulate the Senate in its entirety from removing the filibuster protection. And I think that's important. But Ken, I want to step back for a minute, because I think, you know, your listeners should appreciate the fact that if ever there were a time to ensure the independence of the federal judiciary, it's right now. When President Trump signed an executive order, which in effect was a de facto Muslim ban, it was the federal courts who independently stepped in and put a check on that use of executive power. When the president rolled out his second iteration of the Muslim ban, again, it was another federal judge looking at the context in which the president issued the executive order, using his statements that he intended to create a Muslim ban, and really holding the administration to that standard. It was really a vindication of the role of the courts in our tripartite system of government. So it's important that whoever is appointed to the Supreme Court and confirmed by the Senate have a real commitment to the independence of the federal courts. And I certainly think that looking at the record of Judge Gorsuch, it's pretty clear that he does not take the independence of the judiciary to the degree that we think is necessary into account. And I think that is problematic.
There's also some talk that certain Democrats in red states, Trump states, like Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, you know the list, Joe Manchin, Joe Donnelly, people like that, are under tremendous pressure back home to vote for a Trump Supreme Court justice. So I was going to ask you, do you get a sense that the Democrats have a little more bounce in their step following the defeat of the health care plan, and they may be more aggressive, at least progressive groups may be more aggressive to fight, you know, to make sure the Democrats stay in line?
Well, I certainly think the Democrats, from a morale standpoint, benefited significantly from the defeat of Trump care. I mean, I think the president had articulated his commitment on day one of his administration to supporting legislation that would repeal the ACA. Of course, Republicans in the House and Senate had been working on this now for 6 or 7 years. The fact that they could not organize themselves sufficiently well to actually repeal and replace Obamacare was an indication that, at least with respect to health care, their criticism and their so-called commitment to moving forward was really more talk than action. I think that with regard to the Supreme Court, there is a growing recognition among Democrats that they have a commitment as the party defending the national interest, defending American democracy as we know it. And when you think about a judge whose nomination came about because President Trump farmed out the decision to right-wing political groups like the Heritage Foundation or the Federalist Society, doesn't convince people that the president himself was necessarily committed to the individual nominee as opposed to the process that produced him. So I think Democrats are going to be strong on this. I think they feel the 60-vote standard that Chuck Schumer has articulated is a reasonable standard, and I think they're prepared to hold this president and the Republicans in the Senate to voting on that standard and voting their conscience. I think the left is deeply concerned that Merrick Garland, who was President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court, and after all, the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, the second most powerful circuit in the country, was denied his fair day both to a hearing and to an up or down vote in the Senate. However Senator McConnell chooses to spin it, the truth is he denied a president legitimately elected with a year left in office the right to nominate an individual to the court and to have that nomination treated with respect and dignity and given the hearing that everyone expected him to get. So I think there is tremendous residual anger among Democrats at the treatment of Merrick Garland.
I was just thinking back. I know 1986 was a million years ago, but the thought of Antonin Scalia getting confirmed 98-0, can you ever envision such a vote ever?
No, unfortunately, I can't. But that was a time when I think, this sense of bipartisan sway held the day, that someone like the late Justice Scalia would be approved 98-0 without a rigorous review of his record certainly would not happen today. But I'm just hoping that senators, both Democrats and Republicans, will take a closer look at this nominee and will conclude, as we have done, that the record simply leaves no choice but to oppose his confirmation.
Let me just end with this final note. You're stepping down as head of the leadership conference. What's the scoop on that?
Well, I'm stepping down, Ken, after, as you say, it's been over two decades. I'm stepping down in part because I think it's necessary to bring a new generation of leadership, where appropriate, to organizations like the leadership conference. I mean, I think I've done a pretty good job. I feel I'm leaving at the top of my game, so to speak. But I also think that in Vanita Gupta, who is the new president of the leadership conference, an attorney of extraordinary ability, someone who has headed President Obama's Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Justice now for 2 years, and who was a distinguished trial lawyer, both with the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund and the ACLU long before she came here, is bringing great new talent and energy to the job.
Wade Henderson is, for now, president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, which is spearheading the opposition to Judge Gorsuch's nomination and confirmation to the Supreme Court. You can get more information by going to civilrights.org. Wade, it was wonderful having you on the program.
Ken, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for the invitation.
This could be the start of it.
Next week, voters in California's 34th congressional district will begin the process to pick the successor to Javier Becerra, a Democrat who left the House after he was appointed state attorney general. Becerra has easily held the seat since 1993, and the district is solidly Democratic. Christine Myduke is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times and has been covering the race. Christine, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Well, tell me, where is the 34th district?
So the 34th congressional district in California is really central Los Angeles. It's really in the heart of Los Angeles. It includes downtown Los Angeles, Koreatown, Chinatown, and it goes up into some of the northeast parts of the city, including Highland Park, Eagle Rock, some of the more gentrifying areas.
And it's fair to say it's overwhelmingly Hispanic?
It's definitely overwhelmingly Latino. About two-thirds of the population here is Latino. Another good chunk of voters there are Asian, and it's a pretty diverse district, both in, ethnicity and socioeconomic status.
And it went for Bernie Sanders in the presidential primary, right?
It did. I mean, this district is overwhelmingly progressive. 58% of registered voters here are Democrats, and just 9% are Republicans. And it is one of the few districts in the state that went for Bernie Sanders in the primary.
Okay, so I see for the special election coming up, there are 24 candidates. Most of them, like 20 of them, are Democrats are running. Whom do we need to talk about?
So yeah, there's a very crowded field in this race, 24 candidates, including a write-in that just qualified last week. And, 20 of them are Democrats, and they kind of reflect this overwhelmingly progressive district. There's a lot of people who say that, the policy positions between these progressives are largely the same. I mean, there's not going to be a whole lot of disagreement in terms of, your stance on Trump or immigration or deportation or the, Affordable Care Act. I think that a lot of the discussion has been about personality, experience, and kind of your attitude or approach toward the office. So a few of the candidates that stand out, you know, a lot of people say that Jimmy Gomez, who's a current state assemblyman, is the person to beat. He has a lot of the establishment endorsements, including the state California Democratic Party. And, you know, he's been able to fundraise a lot of money.
Gomez, I mean, you talk about the endorsements. He's backed by Becerra, right? Mayor Garcetti. He seems to be the establishment choice. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of candidates out there have been saying. You know, he definitely has a lot of the establishment endorsements. Javier Becerra, as you mentioned, you know, endorsed him to essentially take his place in this seat. And so in this campaign, depending on who turns out, that could be a liability or an asset.
And of course, if there's any question about whether Donald Trump is playing a role in this campaign, it's answered in this Gomez commercial.
I'm running for Congress in order to fight Trump, because here in California, we have passed some of the most progressive legislation, but all that progress is now threatened by the federal government, by a president that doesn't believe in immigrant rights, LGBT rights, and climate change and the environment. He doesn't believe in workers' rights. So I'm running in order to protect our California values and our California policies at the federal level, to make sure that he doesn't roll those back.
Okay, so the primary is April 4th. Gomez is likely to advance to the runoff. Against whom?
You know, it's really exceedingly hard to say in this race in particular. I mean, with so many candidates that are likely to split the field, it's really just impossible to handicap this one. I think that you see a lot of strong personalities and strong candidates emerging. It's really hard to say who might make it through. There are a few interesting contenders, though. You know, you've got Sara Hernandez, who has experience in LA City Hall as an aide, also a former teacher who's been able to raise a lot of money, and, you know, who said that she was inspired specifically by Trump's election to get out there and fight, you know, fight for immigration issues, healthcare issues. You know, you have Maria Cabildo, who is endorsed by the Los Angeles Times and is a longtime, you know, affordable housing advocate who has been working in the community for a long time. You know, you've got people like Yoli Flores, who is a former Los Angeles school board member. And a lot of these people have said, I was inspired to run because Donald Trump was elected president, because we need to defend all these things that are near and dear to the, you know, hearts of our constituents.
You mentioned Maria Cabildo. I know she was endorsed by the LA Times. And two, let me play a part of her ad.
I think we made a promise to our seniors. You worked hard, you contributed to the system, and we can't take that away. When I'm in Congress, I'm going to do everything I can to fight proposed cuts to Social Security and Medicare.
She's very soft-spoken, isn't she?
She is, actually. She talks about this frequently on the campaign trail and identifies it for people. She has a voice disability. And so she does have a soft voice, but she's actually turned it into an asset, saying, you know, I may have a soft voice, but, you know, I have a very loud voice in terms of speaking out for the issues that you cared about.
If you have 20 or so Democrats running, and obviously, and, you know, California law, it's the top two finishers move on to the runoff. Can a Republican make it into the runoff?
You know, I think that a lot of the conventional wisdom is that that's a distinct possibility. In a field where you've got 20 Democrats running, you know, you have about 60% of the district is registered Democrat. But, you know, with so many people competing for that vote and somewhat strong personalities who might be able to garner a good number of those votes, you know, the Republican might have an advantage and actually be able to squeak through to the top two election in June is what we're anticipating. So, you know, one political data expert said, you know, in any other conventional congressional election, that Republican might have 12 to 14% of the vote off the bat, just Republicans turning out to vote, which they often overperform in low turnout elections in California.
But of course, the conventional wisdom also is if a Republican does make it into the June 6th runoff, he or she will get clobbered by the other Democrat in the race, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, you know, almost assured that if a Republican, the only Republican, gets through to the runoff election, that it would be an easy victory for whichever progressive or Democrat makes it through.
What are you hearing about turnout? Usually these special elections attract a very low turnout.
You know, it's really all over the map, these predictions. I mean, it's really hard to say whether whether the expectations are going to be exceeded. At this point, we just had a city election, actually, in the same area in Los Angeles a month ago. And so there was some question as to voter fatigue, whether people would be confused as to another election just a month later that just has one question on the ballot. And we are seeing some of that in the field. I think some candidates are saying, you know, we have to educate the voters that there's even an election happening and why it's happening. On the low end, I would say that some political consultants think that the turnout could be as low as in the single digits, maybe 9%. While, others say it might actually bump up past like 20% or so, which is still pretty low. But for something that is, such a short election season, a special election, very few people know about it, that could be pretty high. And I think that part of that is attributed to potentially, 20 some odd candidates out there knocking doors, engaging people and trying to get people out to vote.
Just for the record, the primary is April 4th. And the runoff would be June 6th.
That's right.
Christine Myduke is covering the race for the LA Times. And Christine, I should tell you, I was pleased to see on your bio that you are a self-described political junkie.
That's right.
You're on the right program.
Yes. Well, I've been following politics since I was pretty much in high school. So I grew up in a political town in Sacramento. So it's always been a passion.
Christine, it was wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you so much, Ken.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last Supreme Court nominee who had previously sought public office? The answer, Harriet Myers. Myers, the White House counsel to President George W. Bush, was nominated by Bush to the Supreme Court on October 3, 2005. But with it becoming clear that she was in way over her head, she asked the president to withdraw her nomination 24 days later. And she had sought public office in 1989 when she was elected to a 2-year term as an at-large member of the Dallas City Council. The randomly selected winner is Benjamin Ballou of Dobson, North Carolina. Benjamin wins the coveted and curious political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutt winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or a concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. Last week's contest had an Ed Markey for Congress button from Massachusetts, then a Do Burns for Mayor button from Baltimore, and that was followed not by a smiley face, but a frown face button. So when you combine Markey with Do with a frown, you kind of get the Markey Do Sad. Very sad. The winner is Angela Sanders of Conifer, Colorado. We'll have a new Scuttle Button puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
And the forecast calls for pain. The forecast calls for pain. My baby's turning cold, and the forecast calls for pain.
Jimmy Breslin died earlier this month. When you think of the streets of New York, there was nobody who covered the people, their lives, their stories, better than Jimmy Breslin. He spent more than 50 years covering the city at the New York Journal-American, the Herald Tribune, the Post, the Daily News, and Newsday. He took on the powerful and often defended the little guy. He won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary in 1986. And he ran for city council president in 1969, on a ticket with mayoral candidate Norman Mailer, with one of their goals to make New York City the 51st state. And for those who may not know his voice, he was the pitchman for two celebrated commercials back in the day. Here he is for Peel's Beer in 1978.
When Peel's came to me to do this, I said, I'm not Bird or Harry. I'm Jimmy Breslin, a writer. But beer is a subject that's not exactly unknown to me. So I tried one. I liked it. It's good beer. I tried another. It's better than good. It's a good drinking beer. That's how I describe Peel's. It's a good drinking beer.
Peel's, it's a good drinking beer.
And there was another one for post-grape nuts.
Nothing gets my Irish up more than a soggy, wishy-washy cereal. I'm Jimmy Breslin. At breakfast, give me the solid cereal. Grape nut cereal. Every solid bite delivers the full-bodied, nutty taste of toasted grains.
Could you imagine any newspaper columnist anywhere doing a TV commercial or even being recognized enough to do a commercial? That was Jimmy Breslin. Michael Daly knows as much about Jimmy Breslin as anyone on earth. He's a special correspondent with the Daily Beast and previously a columnist with the Daily News and a staff writer with New York Magazine. I was able to catch a few minutes with him the other day coming home from Breslin's funeral.
When big things happen, and to him a big thing could be the assassination of a president, but also a big thing could also be the murder of a kid on a Brooklyn street. When big things happen, that's when you kind of really become who you are. And that's when Jimmy was really Jimmy, I think. I mean, people, there are a million stories that you laugh about. You tell Breslin stories all day and have everybody rolling on the floor. But the, particularly in these days, in this era of fake news and alternate facts, you've got to, I mean, I just spoke at his funeral, and one of the things I was saying was that, you know, brothers and sisters in the media, be like J.B., in the continued pursuit of the truth. And that's ultimately what his whole way of writing, his whole way of reporting, it was about trying to get to what's the most true.
You talked about the story when he went to cover the Crown Heights riots in Brooklyn in 1991. Tell me, I mean, that seems to be vintage Jimmy Breslin.
Well, I was looking, I happened to see a news clip, but I saw a yellow cab burn. I'm saying to myself, well, there's only one person I know who's both stupid enough to take a yellow cab to a riot and, second of all, able to get the cabbie to go there. And I was right. It was J.B. And he also didn't drive. They dragged him out of the cab, set the cab on fire, gave him a pretty good beating, tore off his clothes. And the response to the cops was, you know, how you like your friends now, huh? And the thing about Breslin is he did not change the way he wrote or what he thought or the way he did things one tiniest bit. And he still was right back out in the street. I mean, he was out in the street for the rest of that riot. It isn't like, you know, he had that run in and went home.
He did get some clothing, though.
He did, thank God. Jimmy Breslin without clothing is not something you want to go out of your way to see.
Thank God we're on radio, right?
Yeah, there you go.
So, you know, it sounds like a cliche to say he wrote about the little guy, but I guess, you know, when I think of the memorable stories he's done, I think of the Gravedigger after John Kennedy's assassination. Talk a little bit about that.
I don't think he thought there were any little guys. There were people who were not always noticed. Well, that's not because they're little guys. It's usually because the beholders are the little guys or people with little minds. Well, he covered the burial of John F. Kennedy. He went and he spoke to the guy who dug the grave. And it was the guy who had been in World War II, and he'd gone directly from that to digging graves in Arlington Cemetery for 30 years. And it was kind of American greatness as manifested in dedication to humble work. And he wrote it in such a way that you felt what this guy felt as he's digging the president's grave. I mean, you could feel like the tenderness under the calluses. And I think that just touched what everybody was feeling at the time of that assassination and the time of that burial. And it kind of testified to what survives. And it's also, I mean, if you read the column now, it makes you think how much we often miss. And I think that the present political situation is a lesson in what can happen if decent working people feel abandoned and they fall victim to a charlatan.
I just wonder what Jimmy Breslin, had he been in his prime today, what he would be writing about Donald Trump.
Well, you know, he wrote about Trump exactly in 1989. He talked about beware of a rabble-rouser who seeks to take advantage of the meanness of the crowd. That's what he said about Donald Trump in 1989. You go back and look at what he wrote about Trump over the years. I mean, he had Donald Trump down exactly. In the late 80s and early 90s, I mean, you know, pretty much everybody in New York knew that about Donald Trump.
I know I'm talking to you hours after Jimmy Breslin's funeral. What was that like?
For me, it was beyond sad. I could barely get through it. I mean, there were a lot of very nice things said. His kids all spoke, you know, there was a fair amount of laughter. And, you know, the guy's dead. The guy's gone. You know, that's it. I mean, I carry a New York City press pass, and so did he. And he brought more honor to that press pass than anybody ever did.
He died at age 88, and it sounds like a full life, but everything, when I think about him and I think of your reactions and other reactions to him, it feels like he was still taken too soon.
Yeah, no, he could have done another 100 years. You know, it would have been good. But we had the years that we had, you know, and I think everybody should be grateful for that.
That was part of my conversation with Michael Daly, a special correspondent with the Daily Beast and formerly with the New York Daily News, moments after he spoke at Jimmy Breslin's funeral. Jimmy Breslin, the legendary journalist, died earlier this month at age 88.
I am a passenger. I stay under glass. I look through my window so bright. I see the stars come out tonight. I see the bright and hollow sky. Over the city's ripped back sky. And everything looks good tonight.
It's time for This Week in Political History. It was a shocking moment in a year of shocking moments.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
President Lyndon B. Johnson, besieged by riots at home and an unending war thousands of miles away, stunned the nation 49 years ago this week by announcing he would not seek re-election that year. Sitting in front of the TV, along with my family, I heard the president declare that he decided to stop the bombing over Vietnam, and that took out the majority of his comments. But then, as the president went on, I remember thinking that something else was about to happen.
I have concluded that I should not permit the presidency to become involved in the partisan divisions that are developing in this political year. With American sons in the field far away, with America's future under challenge right here at home, with our hopes and the world's hopes for peace and the balance every day, I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country.
And then he made it official. Julian Zelizer is a presidential historian at Princeton University, and his most recent book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he joins us now. Julian, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Julian, your book is about Johnson, the civil rights movement, and everything he tried to accomplish as president. And I think by most measures, he accomplished a lot. But by 1968, things weren't looking so great.
No, absolutely. The political situation had turned. The conservative coalition of Southern Democrats and Republicans had regained their strength in the 1966 midterm campaigns. Vietnam was consuming the entire agenda. By 1968, he had opponents on the right who said he wasn't tough enough, and opponents on the left who said he was in a war that was unnecessary. And his domestic agenda was stalled. He really wasn't making much progress on the issues he cared about, and he was being pressured by Congress to dramatically cut spending on domestic policy. So going into the new year, everything seemed to be turning the wrong way for this president.
And that had to be a huge disappointment for Johnson, pushing for civil rights and racial equality and watching America's streets burn at the same time.
It did. The riots that take place in the summer of 67 in Detroit and Newark, New Jersey, and also in some other smaller cities, were really devastating to him. He couldn't understand why those problems continued and why the legislation that he passed, in his mind, wasn't appreciated enough. And that there was still protest and there was still chaos in his mind even after those gains. So he was incredibly frustrated. He was pushing for an open housing bill, and it stalled in 1966. It stalled in 1967. It stalled, and he was trying to get it through in 68 as the presidential campaign was getting started.
What had he done to promote a second term? I mean, I know he, when he was on the ballot in New Hampshire, he was on as a write-in candidate, but had he done anything, had he gone through any motions for his candidacy?
Well, I think what he was doing was, he still was planning to run, and I think what he was doing is ultimately planning that the power of incumbency, even with all the controversy that was going on, would be enough to carry him through for another term. He didn't put everything he had into the New Hampshire primary, for example, and he underestimated the kind of threat that a Eugene McCarthy could pose to him. So I think even with the problems, he was gearing up to rest on his accomplishments as the basis for the next campaign.
How much did the results in New Hampshire and Bobby Kennedy getting in the race shortly afterwards, how much do you think that affected his decision not to run?
It affected him. We have to remember he had spoken earlier in 67 several times. He had suggested he might not run again, and he often went through these periods where he seemed pretty depressed about the state of politics, and he suggested he didn't want to do any more with this. And there was a lot of this that had nothing to do with McCarthy and Kennedy. It was just about the dire condition of his presidency because of the issues we've discussed. That said, when McCarthy does pretty well and then Kennedy enters into the race, I do think he felt as if he was almost under siege within his own party and that the possibility of that automatic reelection was no longer so certain. And obviously, Robert Kennedy in particular was someone he always was fearful of, always was angry about. So I think it was a double punch in some ways that wasn't the reason he ultimately stepped out of this race, but it certainly helped push him in that direction.
Do you think he would have been renominated?
I still think he might have. I mean, I understand many people suspect, obviously, if Robert Kennedy wasn't assassinated, he would have been the victor. But I don't know. I think Johnson, even in early 68, even with all the problems, I still think he had a chance of defeating them and still of being the best coalitional Democratic candidate to defeat a Republican. And he was very savvy. We can't forget that. You know, in 64, he put together a pretty skillful campaign. And I think he could have gained the nomination. I think he still could have done well against Nixon. And I think just because he stepped out doesn't mean that he should have stepped out or that his loss was inevitable.
Just thinking back, you know, you think of the elation by some over Johnson's decision not to run, but then you think of the horrible things, Dr. King, Bobby Kennedy, the convention, all the terrible things that went on the rest of the year.
No, absolutely. And the criticism, obviously, by that time was focused on his Vietnam policy, was focused for many Democrats on the limits of what he achieved. But we also have to remember what people now look back to are some of the amazing gains he was able to make early in his presidency. And many of his fiercest critics, I think, by March and April of 68, going into that summer, had just put that part of Lyndon Johnson's legacy to the side. And certainly for the president himself, that was absolutely tragic. But in some ways, liberals and the Democratic Party as a whole would forget some of the very important accomplishments that took place early in his presidency.
Julian Zelizer is a presidential historian at Princeton University and author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Julian, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
It was 49 years ago this week, on March 31st, 1968, that President Lyndon Johnson stunned the nation by announcing he would not seek a second term as president. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content, including past episodes, and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.